Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Texas Titans podcast, and Merry, Merry Christmas. I cannot believe 2019 is about to come to a close. I just, I love this time of year. I am a Christmas nut. My girls, whenever they were younger, they used to call me Clark W. Griswold because I am all in it when it comes to the holidays. And I'm so excited that in 2019, I launched this little passion project known as the Texas Titans podcast. And I have got a great, great, great episode for you guys today. My guest is Willie Baronet. Willie is an ad executive, entrepreneur, turned artist who in 1993 began what would probably culminate into one of the most significant things that he's ever done in his entire life. And what he did in 1993 is he purchased his very first homeless sign. So whenever you see someone who is homeless asking for help, the sign that they're holding, Willie in 1993 started buying these signs, and he has been doing so ever since. And that has culminated into the We Are All Homeless, which you can check out at wearealhomeless.org. That's what started that project that Willie began to raise awareness for the homeless problems across the country and across the world for that matter. And then he decided to turn that into art. By taking the signs and doing art installations where he displays the homeless signs. And I got to tell you, when you see these signs without the human being behind them to where you feel more comfortable just taking the time to stop and read them, and then you picture that human that once held that sign, it's pretty powerful. And I really enjoyed sitting down with Willie and talking about this. And one of the most magnificent things he's done as a part of this whole project is he created the documentary Signs of Humanity, which you can go watch on Amazon Prime. It is it's really powerful. Willie talks to some of the folks and in my opinion, does one of the best jobs I've ever seen of humanizing these individuals who have stories ranging far and wide as to why they're in the positions they are, the education level, the past. I mean, what you find in this, and we talk about this in our conversation in the interview, that you find that there's some common denominators amongst a lot of them, and it's not all because they're all mentally incapacitated. It's not because they're all addicted to substances, narcotics, or whatever the case may be. That is a lot of it. It absolutely is a lot. But what Willie has found as he's gone across the country and around the world meeting these folks is that a lot of the stories we create in our minds about them are inaccurate. So we talk about that, and it's just, I really think that you're going to enjoy this interview. Willie is just a terrific guy, and I really think he's doing something important here, so enjoy it. Now, I'm going to read you a little bit of Willie's bio, which is quite extensive, and he is an incredibly accomplished designer and was an accomplished guy in the advertising industry, where he owned his own firm for years before selling it, and then going from ad executive to artist, and has made that transition pretty remarkably well, to say the least. So, Willie Baronet, Stan Richards Professor in Creative Advertising at Southern Methodist University. Willie Baronet is the former owner and creative director of Group Baronet, now Mason Baronet. His advertising and design work has been featured in Communications Art, Graphis, AIGA, Graphic Design Annual, New York Art Directors Annual, The One Show, Print Case Books, Annual Report Trends, The Type Directors Club Annual, Annual Report Design, A Historical Retrospective, 1510 to 1990, organized by the Cooper Witt National Museum of Design. His print and broadcast work has received numerous medals from the Dallas Advertising League's Top Show, the Dallas Society of Visual Communications, and the Houston Art Directors Club. In 1999, he was a juror for the Communication Arts Illustration Annual. In 2013, Baronet was named an IAGA Fellow for making a significant contribution to raising the standards of excellence in practice and conduct in the creative community. This is the highest honor an AIGA chapter can bestow upon one of its senior level members. Baronet has been buying and collecting homeless signs since 1993 as part of a long-term art project titled We Are All Homeless. In 2014, he began a 31-day cross-country trip to buy signs in 24 cities, which was the subject of the documentary Signs of Humanity, which premiered at the Dallas International Film Festival and has been accepted into 7 additional festivals. He has done exhibits featuring these signs across the U.S. and in the U.K. The project has been featured in dozens of international and local media, including Yahoo News, NPR, All Things Considered, HuffPost, Al Jazeera America, BuzzFeed, Fast Company's blog, posted by Katie Couric, and dozens of others. An upworthy video about the project that was uploaded on August 31st, 2015, has been viewed over 6.4 million times. Over the years, Baronet has spoken to schools and organizations across the country about creativity, leadership, and his homeless project, including TEDx, Pichacucha, Ignite, DFW, Creative Mornings, Catalyst University, AIGA, DSVC, and the How Design Conference. In his advertising career, Baronet has worked with clients in just about every industry. He has served on the board of directors for the Dallas Society of Visual Communications and the advisory board of the DFW AIGA. In 2006, Baronet sold the Group Baronet Company to longtime employee Holly Mason, and the company was renamed Mason Baronet. Baronet is a 1982 graduate of the University of Southwestern Louisiana, now the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. In May 2011, Baronet graduated from the University of Texas at Dallas, UTD, with an MFA in Arts and Technology. He has taught advertising design at Texas Christian University, Brookhaven Community College in Dallas, A&M at Commerce, and taught as visiting faculty for the MA program at Syracuse University. Baronet was also the technical editor for the premier issue of Advertising for Dummies, though reluctant to admit it. So that's a little bit about this incredibly accomplished guy that I just had the best time sitting down and visiting with. I hope you will check out Signs of Humanity on Amazon Prime. It's definitely worth it. Also, go check out weareallhomeless.org. Get involved in any way you can. And I really think you're going to enjoy this. And, you know, given the subject matter of this episode, I hope, and I don't want to get preachy. I'm not going to do that. So don't worry. Don't do the little 30-second fast forward. But I do just, what it did for me is it made me really take stock of how thankful I am, in particular at this time of year, that I have great family to be surrounded with, and just two amazing daughters who are healthy, and just count our blessings. Let's just count our blessings. And I hope all of you have a very, very Merry Christmas. For those of you who have been listening to the Texas Titans podcast the whole time, and those of you who are new, thank you. I could not be more grateful. As I move into 2020, I look back on 2019, and this was by far one of my greatest achievements. It had nothing to do with money. That's not what this is about, obviously. It's just about getting to sit down and visit with really accomplished people and hear their stories and share them with you. And for you to be along the ride with me has meant the world to me. So thank you for that. I hope you have an incredibly blessed Christmas and a happy 2020. And with that, here is my conversation with Willie Baronet. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks, folks. Hey, folks, I've got a question for you. Moms, dads, grandmas who love their grandchildren, grandpas who actually are willing to get out and shop for a grandchild every now and then, godparents. Have you purchased your little ones their Christmas PJs yet? Have you? Because if you haven't, you need to get on that right now. I mean, these little tykes have been running around here in the month of December, sugar plums all dancing in their head. They need to be properly attired when the big guy comes squeezing down that chimney. You hear what I'm saying? They need their Christmas PJs, and I'm going to tell you where you need to go get them. You need to go to today's sponsor, Hot Tots, located at 4855 Old Bullard Road. That's in La Piazza Shopping Center in Tyler, Texas, right behind Broadway Square Mall. Okay? And here is something else that you may want to store away in that noodle. Hot Tots is a regionally designated North Pole supplier. Now, so here's how this works. So Santa, being, you know, he's sitting there, he's watching Bezos crush it with Amazon's, all the technology, the logistics, and getting the shipping done. And Santa's like, you know, I've been doing this stuff in one night. I don't know what the big deal is, but maybe I can learn something from Bezos. So he has decided to coordinate with the greatest, the premier, the creme de la creme toy stores all around the world and partner with them. Well, as your luck would have it, Texas Titan listener, Hot Tots was one of those selected locations. So therefore, you can come to Hot Tots right here at the last minute. Oh, and by the way, you can do it all the way up till Christmas Eve. You can even go in on Sunday because Hot Tots has been open for 7 days a week through the holiday season. I know a thing about this because I happen to intern there. I know the boss. I know the owner. She's a tough cookie. And she works me pretty hard, but she is kind enough to repay me by sponsoring today's program. So, if you don't get it all done, if you haven't gotten it all done, come on in Saturday. Come in Sunday. And guess what? As fate would have it, we've got a couple of days next week to get those last-minute shopping gifts done. Oh, and if Santa hasn't, if you haven't gotten the list of Santa yet, no problem. There is an official North Pole registered mail receptacle inside of Hot Tots. So if you want to bring your little one in to write a letter to Santa, come on into Hot Tots. They can do that. We love that. So, I mean, it's kind of big. We're kind of proud of that, you know, is that to be chosen as an official mail receptacle for the North Pole. So, as you get ready for the big guy to trek around, come to Hot Tots, see what we've got. And guess what? If you're one of those kind of odd people that Santa wraps the gifts, I mean, you guys are kind of high maintenance. The guy's got enough to do. He's having to keep the elves happy, trying to get them to not form a union, trying to make sure the sleigh's ready to go all around the globe in one night delivering all these toys. And then some of you actually ask him to wrap the gifts. That's just a little high maintenance, if you ask me. But if you are one of those, well, guess what? If you coordinate with Santa to have your gift come from Hot Tots, they will wrap it. Professional wrappers on staff ready to do your high maintenance wrapping if you need it. Or if it's just a gift, come on in and get it wrapped whenever you buy at Hot Tots. Okay, now here's another thing. If you can't make it in, call them at 903-534-5888. They will take care of you. They're constantly emailing, texting pictures of what's in the store, new items that have come in. They can take care of you. This is a high touch, high customer service business. Also, follow Hot Tots. That's HAUTETOTZ on Instagram because they're constantly posting new arrivals of toys, clothing, everything all the time. Next year in 2020, they will celebrate the grand opening of Hot Tots Online. But until then, come on in, come see them, go on the Instagrams, follow them and look at new arrivals. And if you don't see something you like, if there's something you've seen somewhere else and you want to get it right here in Tyler, call 903-534-5888. Reagan, Teresa, Jimlin, they are ready to take care of you at once. So with that, have a very, very Merry Christmas. And if you want to make it extra merry, go see the folks at Hot Tots, today's Texas Titan sponsor. Thank you. All right. Well, Willie Baronet, how are you, my man?
I'm good.
Well, all right. I've got to tell you now, in case you, I've been rattling on and on off recorder because I've been so excited to do this interview. Jimlin and I, after we watched Signs of Humanity, your documentary about homelessness and your sign project, I was so excited to sit down with you and learn more about your story. And so, but before we get to that, I want to talk about kind of Willie Baronet, the beginning, you know, where are you from?
how did you, I know you started out in advertising, and kind of let's tie this all together to get to what is really, I'm selfish. What I'm really interested in is to learning more about your homeless project that you've launched that I think is so, so amazing. So first of all, let's start, where are you from, and go from there.
So I was born and raised in Lafayette, Louisiana. Big Cajun family.
Good food city, man.
Really, really good food. Yeah. I didn't realize how good the food was until I left. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, wow, people don't eat like that all the time.
Right.
And went to high school at Lafayette High School, went to college in Lafayette at what was then USL. It's now University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Mm-hmm. And changed my major a couple of times, but ended up in advertising design. And soon after graduating, moved to Dallas, mainly because Dallas was a big market. They had a lot of really good work going on here. So there's, you know, I'll always, a piece of my heart will always live in South Louisiana. But Dallas has been my home for over 30 years.
And what were you doing when you first came here? Did you come here for advertising, for school? Or
I did. I came to Dallas with my little portfolio and interviewed at a bunch of places and finally got a job and moved here as an art director, and over the course of the next few years worked as a graphic designer, art director, eventually as a creative director, and then in 1992 started a company and was terrified. And so I basically spent all of my professional life, or the biggest chunk of my first professional life, in advertising design.
Now, were you an artistic child? Was that an outlet for you as a youth, or when did that start to develop?
You know, it's funny because I came from a family that did not really, I don't think my parents knew what to do with me, because I did love to draw even when I was really, really young. In fact, my mom had a drawing of Snoopy that I did when I was 7 years old. She kept it in her purse, I think, into my adulthood. She was still showing it off. So there was some, I think they were proud of that in a way, but they really didn't know how to encourage it.
Right.
But yeah, it was an outlet for me, and I didn't ever think it could become part of my professional life until I was in college.
Really? Really? And what did that look like? When did you decide that this is something I could actually pursue and get paid to do what I love?
So I went from pre-law to math, and then was like wondering what the heck I was doing in math in Calculus 2, and was flipping through a course catalog back when they were books, and was flipping through it, and I saw advertising design. And that was the first time, I didn't really know what that was, but it was the first time that it occurred to me, oh, that sounds interesting.
And right.
My first art class, I knew I was in the right place.
Awesome. So now, one of the things you touched on briefly, so the podcast, a lot of it, I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs, very business focused a lot of the time. You kind of cover both aspects. I mean, you kind of got it all. You know, you've got the artistic side, business, academic, and obviously some very profound charitable endeavors. But talk to me about when you decided to hang out your own shingle, some of the good, the bad, and the ugly of that, because that's one of the things I always try to bring out in my podcast, because I say this a lot. A lot of people think they want to be an entrepreneur, but they've never been an entrepreneur. And then, you know, you get in there and you realize, oh man, this is a lot tougher than I thought. It's not just, you know, you're the boss. You can take off anytime you want. So for you, what led you to go out on your own? And then take us through some of the experiences whenever all of a sudden you're having to pay the light bill.
Well, I did not ever really imagine myself as an entrepreneur. My dad was not. He had a job he worked at his whole life till he retired. And I didn't really know, I didn't have a role model for that. I worked for a series of design firms and ad agencies and quickly saw, I watched how things worked. And I think I learned about what to do and what not to do. And realized back then, if you could afford a computer and a few tools, there wasn't a huge barrier to entry.
Right.
I didn't know what I was doing. But we started small, and there was three of us in the beginning. And over the course, I owned this company for 15 years. Over the course of that time, we grew to over 16 people and you know, a lot of revenue. At one point, I remember my monthly expenses were $120,000, and I would wake up and go, what the hell am I doing?
Right.
So a lot of it was learning on the job. A lot of it, I think I'm fairly risk averse in some ways. So I was a pretty frugal business owner. I saw previous employers waste money.
Yep.
So I think we were all smart about spending money wisely, and we just worked hard. Yeah. The truth is that we outworked a lot of our competitors, and hopefully we were doing good work too.
Yeah. And would you say that, like, because there's good days and bad days, I don't care if you're what you're doing, because you were, again, we talked about this off, you know, we offline, and it's one of the things I always try to drive home in the podcast, and just like I said to my daughters, following your passion and doing what you love. I mean, you're an entrepreneur, but you're doing it in a space that you've got a passion for. So what did it mean to you to get to fulfill your passion for art and for the creative side of you? Did that help you overcome some of those tough days of just that every entrepreneur has? I mean, what was that like?
No question. For me, the actual work was a blast. It was great for somebody with a short attention span, which is me. It was great for people who like creative problem solving and art and illustration and design and being clever, all of the stuff. I think I was voted most likely, I don't remember what it was. It was essentially I was voted to be most likely to be a smartass. No, I think it was wittiest. That's what it was. When I was in high
school.
That's
a diplomatic way of saying
it. I was voted wittiest, which I judged to be just about if I was the biggest smartass. But
right.
The skills of being sarcastic and a class clown, in some ways, that translates to advertising. And there's a lot about it it's about understanding people and figuring out what will compel them. Mm-hmm. And then what's a clever way to do that? And what's a fun way to execute that? So, and I think the things like selling and the business side of this, those were things that came later. I later realized I do kind of like business development. I like the competition of it. But my heart was always in the creative side of things.
Okay. All right. So you do that for 15 years. And it's 92 you make an exit? That
no, 92 is when it started.
Yeah,
we sold it in 2006.
Okay. And tell me what that's like. And I've talked to entrepreneurs. As a matter of fact, I was kind of surprised by the answer of an entrepreneur that had a wildly successful business. I mean, had a $70 million exit. You know, I'm thinking, wow, did you miss it? And he's like, absolutely not. I'm fine being able to travel 260 days a year and, you know, and have plenty of money. But a lot of people, it's like that their first child. So for you, what was that process gearing up towards the sale and then kind of take us post, you know, event?
So very much a mixed bag because I loved this company. I felt my identity was wrapped up in leading this company. It was my family. Mm-hmm. We were a really tight group of people. My mom passed away in 2003, and that rocked my world. I think it rocked our whole family in a lot of ways. But in some respect, it was a wake-up call.
Right.
And I realized, it was like I wanted to reevaluate, is this how you want to keep doing what you're doing? And what I realized is that I still loved a lot about the business, but I had done, it's like how many campaigns or websites or whatever do I need to do before I realize, well, I can do that. And we won plenty of awards. It's like, I didn't need that kind of recognition. And at the same time, blogging appeared in the world. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I was blogging and most of it was posting these drawings, just sketches. And I started to connect with bloggers all over the world. We started to comment on each. It's like I could almost see social media happening before Facebook.
Right.
And I realized at one point that I was having more fun doing that than I was running a business. And a number of other things happened. Part of it, our building, which is now the House of Blues, used to be the White Swan Building.
Yeah.
That's a picture right there of the White Swan Building.
Okay.
And when that got sold, there were a number of things that happened that made it financially and timing-wise was the right time.
Right.
And one of my employees was ready to step up, and it just was the right time. And I knew in my heart that this was the universe telling me it's time to do this. I knew that art was coming. I didn't really know, like you asked about post.
Yep.
Afterwards, I woke up one day without a job.
Yeah.
And that was disorienting.
Yeah.
I spent a couple of years taking a few art classes and just really trying to figure out what I really wanted to do. And it was in that time period that I decided I'm going back to grad school. I'm going to study art with both feet in the boat, and I'm going to see what happens. And it was while I was in grad school, you know, I'd been buying homeless signs back since 1993.
Yep.
But it was in grad school that my professors were like, you got to do something with
yeah.
this.
Yeah. And so that's a perfect segue, because literally that's the gaps that I wanted to fill in, because I knew you started the business 92. I knew you bought your first sign in 93. Then there's 15 years in there where I want to know, was this idea baking? And then there was, correct me if I'm wrong, like a couple of years after you sold the business, you go to school. So, I mean, the whole signs of humanity, buying the signs, letting that be your art. I mean, that's got a long history. It's kind of like they say, an overnight success. Well, that was a long overnight. It's, you know, right? So kind of tell me what was happening at the time. What led you to buy that first sign? And you give us kind of some texture around that. And then for the next 15 years, you're still buying them. What's that look like until this all of a sudden becomes what it is today?
So I had this idea, and it was really, I think it came from the fact that I felt uncomfortable, and I didn't like how I felt when I ignored people standing on a corner holding a sign. And so in my head, I had started to think about, I think I'm going to see if they will sell me their signs. And I was actually in the car with Tanya the very first mm-hmm, time. Mm-hmm. She was driving, and I had told her that this thing, and we saw somebody, and so she was in the driver's seat, so she technically bought the first sign. And I was like, oh my God, and it changes everything.
Really?
And so I continued buying signs, and 15 years go by. In that time, occasionally I ruined a couple of the early signs because I thought, oh, I need to paint on the signs and do something. And so I did that, but that didn't feel right. I kept buying them. I would put them up in my office or at home, and people would, if I would have been paying attention, I would have noticed how people reacted when they saw the signs.
Mm.
I didn't need to do anything to the signs.
Yeah.
And so they were just continuing to accumulate. The idea of them being part of an art project was there, but not clear. And it was when I went to school, I'm literally talking to my new professors, and they were saying, so what do you want to do? And I showed them some of my paintings, and I said, and I've also got all these signs I've been buying. And I could just see in their eyes, they were like, you got to do something with this.
Yeah.
And so I just focused on it, and I started to think about it. That's when We Are All Homeless was born. I remember the night I was in a night class, that I went online and found the URL was available, and I bought it.
Wow.
And that was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But it was in class with a bunch of other artists who I later was in art collectives with, and we collaborated on work, that I found the voice for this.
Yeah.
And I finally went, okay, I don't need to mess with these signs. I really just need to find a way to artfully present them.
Yeah. And so, well, first of all, do you still have the first sign you bought?
I'm sure I do.
I don't
get rid of any signs.
Yeah.
So yes.
And how many signs have been since then?
1,800
yeah.
plus.
Yeah. From all over the country, right?
And I think 10 or 11 countries now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So you start buying the signs, not exactly sure how you're going to artistically display them. But then does it become a deliberate thing? Are you now seeking them out, or is it still, if I'm on the streets of Manhattan and I see a homeless person with a sign, I'm going to offer to buy it. You know, what is it more? So in other words, is it more passive or does it become more deliberate to collect versus just, you know, oh, there's one. How does that take shape?
I'd say in the last 26 years, it has generally been when I see one,
yep,
I'll buy it.
Yep.
With the exception of when we decided to make a documentary to travel across the United States, you know, in 31 days from Seattle to New York City, that was a very specific, we're going to do this, yep, deliberate road trip and we are going to buy signs in every city where we can find signs.
Yeah. And so now take me back to, you buy the URL to We Are All Homeless. At that time, do you really know what you're going to do? Or is, no, it just you? Is it just like all of a sudden you've decided that you have a calling, there's something happening in this space, you want to bring awareness to homelessness, or it's touching you, but you don't really know exactly what that's going to look like, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so you're collecting the signs. Now let's go to, when does the acorn become planted to make the film Signs of Humanity?
So I do the first art show in 2009.
Okay.
A friend of mine, Hal Samples, had a gallery, and it was his last show before he sold his gallery, and it was my first show, and he and I both had this homelessness connection. And so I did this first show, got a lot of feedback from that, and it was after that that I think it was 2000. So I graduated in 2011. I had a big show for my graduation. And then in 2012, I did my first TEDx talk about this. Mm-hmm. And it was during that talk, and I swear this was just off the top of my head, I said, you know, one of these days I'd really like to travel across the United States and buy signs all across this great country. And, you know, when you do a TEDx talk, that's online.
Yep.
And so I realized, wow, I better actually do that.
Right.
And so that was the beginning of starting to plan for it. And I called my friend Tim, who ended up traveling with me across the country, along with two other filmmakers, and he and I began plotting a route.
Yeah.
And it started off as a little tiny thing, and before it was over with, we had raised enough money, and one of the donors said, I want you to make a feature-length documentary. A guy named David Kiger, who still to this day, he is the CEO of Worldwide Express, and he still does all of our shipping for free. And
really?
I have shipped a lot of boxes of signs, yeah, in the past 5 years.
Wow.
And so he was I think he saw something that I didn't see at the very beginning. And so all of a sudden we had a film crew. We had five or six different cameras. We had two vehicles and we didn't know what the hell we were doing.
Right.
But that was the beginning of this adventure. The other thing that happened because of this because of making the documentary, from the very first city, Seattle, the Seattle Times said, we'd like to interview you. And almost every city we went to, papers, radio stations, TV stations were following us around, interviewing us and or sometimes the folks that we were buying signs from.
Wow. So obviously, okay, so the sign purchasing comes as kind of a remedy for your discomfort, for just, you don't want to ignore them and you want to do something. And I think that's the most remarkable thing that comes through in the film is that it, and it's very rightfully named, Signs of Humanity, it brings to them their humanity that they actually, probably a lot of them, of these folks, for the first time in many, many years, realize they have something of value, you know, and I mean that on a literal and a philosophical right perspective, and you bring that to them. So how did the film making it, where all of a sudden now it becomes a deliberate thing where you're seeking these folks out and you start to hear the stories, how did it change you? How did it change your perspective on this whole thing?
Well, I don't know if it changed it as much as it enhanced it, because
yep,
what I had already experienced even before the documentary is when I had a long conversation with somebody, And I had conversations with people who broke down crying while we were talking. I had people that were just laughing it up, and I had people that wanted to keep talking and would tell the cars behind me, blowing their horns, to screw off. And the conversations changed everything for me.
Yeah.
For one thing, the fact that they had a sign that I wanted and I had money that they wanted, it did put us on a different kind of footing, and it changed our dynamic. But I started to hear these stories, and I started to realize that the stories I made up in my head were quite different than the one that I heard.
Yeah.
And that was a big shift. So traveling across the country was basically just enhancing that, and getting to do it 31 days in a row for long periods of time. And we did 30-minute interviews. And so I got to have really in-depth conversations.
So, and you, that's an excellent, you teed up something I wanted to ask you about, because you had a perception, you had an idea, and then you had the conversation, and that perception or that idea was changed. What were those changes, and what do you think, generally speaking, are some of the biggest misconceptions that people have about homeless folks?
So part of, I think, where I would start with that is, I know that we're hardwired as human beings. There was a time, a million years ago or however long ago, when we were worried about being eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. And we, in our primitive selves, had to figure out who's on my side, who's against me, who's in my tribe, who can I trust. So this instinct to prejudge and to size people up, which I think most of us do instinctually, I think is natural. However, what that also does is it sometimes creates a false us and them, because now that we're evolved and now that I'm willing to, okay, I've got my primitive brain, but I can set that aside here, and I can actually, hey, Justin, I can listen to you and find out what the real story is, even though I might have judged you just because of how you look and how you smile and whatever else. And that happens with people on the corner. I still do it. Right. My human nature is always going to do it. But what I've learned is, okay, that's what you think is going to be the story. Then I go have a conversation and find out, wow. Like, I met a woman in Austin 15 years ago, missing a leg, holding a sign, missing a leg. I had made up a story. She's going to be whining and coming off as a victim. One of the most confident women told me the story of how she lost her leg, was funny, and we had this amazing conversation. And I remember driving away going, wow, that is not what I expected.
Yeah.
And that has happened hundreds of times.
Yeah.
In Chicago, I remember seeing a middle-aged black woman with two little girls. She did not want to be interviewed for the documentary because she wanted to protect her, what turns out to be her granddaughters. And her name was Poochie. She was powerful. I don't know of a better word to say it. She just said, look, I've got subsidized housing here in Chicago. I am solely responsible for these two little girls. And I have not figured out a better way to make the $70 a month I need to pay for the subsidized housing than by doing this. And she was so clear of purpose, and she wasn't apologetic about it. And I was, again, I had a story made up that she was going to be, had to have a different attitude, and she didn't. So, and I could just go on and on with stories like that. But that's the thing, is that it changes the way I prejudge people.
One of my favorite, this a little comedic relief, if you will, from the film. And by the way, to the listener, go to Amazon Prime and check out Signs of Humanity. It's there. If you're a Prime subscriber, you have no excuse, because it doesn't cost, you're already paying for it. And it is a phenomenal film. But one of the things that Jimlin and I cracked up about, and you couldn't see, you could only, it was a voiceover. You could only hear the lady. You couldn't see her voice, but you know, you go up to everyone, you ask them, can I buy your sign? And it seemed like most of the time, with the exception of a veteran, he did not want to give up his sign because he was proud of it, which to me, that was another misconception, is that, you know, wow, he had really associated true value and identity with that sign, which I thought was remarkable. But one of the funniest things from the video was you offer a lady, and again, I couldn't see her. You could only hear the voice. It's in Detroit. You offer her 15. She says, I'll take 20. And so it's like, and okay, and I don't want to overthink this, but in my mind, I immediately thought, wow, there's a talent there. She's a natural negotiator. I mean, she is negotiating the sale of her cardboard sign just instinctively. That's a talent that she holds that no one sees. And you found it in the course of this project, which I thought was pretty awesome. And then one of the things, too, that struck me, Willie, was the hope that many of the folks had. I mean, they were so, you know, there was one lady that was, I can't remember what town she was in, but she was probably, you know, in her 60s, and she wanted to start. Oh, she wanted to start a shelter that would accept pets.
That was Danelle. She was 78 years old.
Wow.
In Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Albuquerque, that's her. That's her. And I'm sort of thinking, you know, how remarkable it is, and it just touched me that she has a goal to start something that will benefit people like her instead of just being so inwardly focused, which I thought was pretty remarkable. And what was like it, and this may be an impossibility for you to do, but do you have like a top three or top two stories or people? I know, what's the gentleman's name that came on the TED Talk with you?
Eddie.
I know that's got to be a top one.
Eddie's probably number one.
Yeah, because, talk about Eddie.
So I met Eddie in Philadelphia. He was in Center City holding a sign. His sign says, "Something to ponder, what if God occasionally visits Earth disguised as a homeless person to see how charitable we are?"
Yeah.
And so I could tell just from his sign that he had a good sense of humor. Now, you may remember from the film, he's got scabs on his face.
Yeah.
He looks really rough, has a really thick Philly accent. So we talked a little bit about that in the film. He talks about how he got the idea for that sign. 2 years go by, and I was doing a talk about this project somewhere, and I had a picture of his sign behind my head, and a photographer took a picture of that, and then that was on Facebook. And I get this random Facebook message from some dude named Eddie Dunn in Philadelphia, and this is 2 years later, and he says, "Hey, man, you probably don't remember me, but I'm the guy that made that sign." And of course I remembered him because he's in the movie, which I see all the time, and I had to edit, so I saw his face all the time. And so we started a dialogue. He tells me, "You didn't know this when you bought the sign, but I was a heroin addict. The reason he had scabs on his face is that he had OD'd multiple times, fallen out of the back of a car onto the concrete face first, had been brought back by emergency personnel coming and finding him." He told me that over the course of our conversation that he had gone to jail so that he could get sober, has now been sober for a year and a half, was sponsoring people in AA, had reconnected with his son and his daughter, had a new grandson, which I think really helped give him some clarity.
Yeah.
And had a job in Lancaster. And so he and I continued talking. I was about to go to Philadelphia to do a big exhibit in 2016. And turns out I went and picked him up at the train station. We had lunch. I took him to the exhibit where he could see his sign on the wall. He stood there and started crying, just remembering that. And I think it was the first time he'd laid eyes on that sign since then. So he and I stayed in touch. I did a research project with a woman named Rosie Frasso in Philadelphia. We've done two projects now. We invited Eddie to be in our panel discussion, so he was able to talk about life behind a sign, about the kind of abuse and what it's like. And that's another thing we could talk about for hours. But anyway, that led us to eventually, I invited him to join me on stage for a TEDx talk, and it was so profound for me to be able to ask Eddie questions on stage about what it was like to be on the other side of that. And he and I think, are going to be good friends forever. He has got a big heart. He continues to help any way. I mean, I can call him anytime, and he will say yes, no matter what the request is. So Eddie's number one on the list.
Yeah.
But I don't have another relationship quite that deep with anyone.
Well, yeah, that was such a cool story. Now, I mean, to see him on the TED Talk, and again, I encourage anyone listening to go check out that TED Talk, because Eddie gives his story. He's an insurance adjuster now. I mean, he holds down a job. And I mean, it's just that's just a chapter of his life.
Well, I got to tell you one other thing. One of the more recent times I was in Philly, this probably just in the last year or so, he said, "You know, you'd never been to my house," and by his apartment, and he said, "This is my home." You know, and so we've talked about home a lot. Yeah. And so I go with him and we walk in, and he has one of our Signs of Humanity movie posters framed on the wall. So we take a selfie with that. And I mean, I can feel it right now, just how potent that is for me to feel that connection with him and his pride in having, he's got a grown son that he is helping out right now. And you know, he is just a big-hearted guy who has whatever it was, but he went to jail to figure it out.
Right.
And it worked.
Wow. Well, I know that, and there's something that you talked about. You said that word, home, and you asked the question throughout the film to different folks, what does home mean to you? And I think that's the part where, you know, Gemma looked at me, she's like, "Oh my gosh, Jason, I don't know if I can make it through this without just, you know, breaking down," because... And it really, there was a moment in my life that I, first of all, I have never been homeless. I've never been on the brink of homelessness. But there was one time when I was in transition to where I didn't have a permanent home, so to speak. And I remember just the frustration, the anxiety, the restlessness that caused for me. And by the way, to the listener, do not feel sorry for me. The places where I did stay whenever I did not have a permanent home were very nice. I was nothing compared to what these folks had, and it wasn't so pleased. I'm not trying to put myself in that position, but my point being, in my comfortable first world, even when I didn't have a home that I went home to every night for a period, and I didn't know where that next home was going to be, it just caused the rest of life to have a sense of anxiety. That really came through in the film to me. Whenever you started asking, what does home mean to you? Like I heard words like peace, security, love.
One for me is safety.
Safety.
Based on my own childhood.
Yeah.
And that came up a couple of times when I asked folks. And so I immediately wonder if maybe they experienced a certain kind of abuse or something that caused them to key in on that word. But I now have thousands of answers to that question, because I also, at art exhibits of the signs, I typically put up some scrap cardboard with some Sharpies, and I ask people to answer, what is home?
Yeah.
And so that, for me, has become a really profound extension of this. And you got to hear a little bit of synopsis toward the end of the documentary.
So... what would you say are some of the, you know, from, you know, Texas to Seattle, what are some of the greatest commonalities that you found? Be it not just their, this is how they get by, but maybe the things that you found, were there certain defining moments in their life where there's, I mean, is it abuse? Is it substance abuse? And that's another thing I would like to touch on a little bit, the substance abuse in just a minute. I'm going to try to remember to come back to that, but... what are some of the common threads you saw in these folks, good, bad, or ugly? You know.
So, in general, I would say I was most surprised by how different everybody's stories were. At the same time, some of the things that I've learned, and I'm no expert on homelessness, I feel like a student, and I'll probably always be a student of this issue. But I have realized that for a lot of women, domestic abuse is often one of the things that leads them to be on the streets. For a lot of veterans, PTSD and other issues are often at the root of despair and or a loss of hope and being on the street, and lack of ability to get certain kinds of medical attention leads them to drugs and alcohol. Over a third of the people on the street have a diagnosable mental illness.
Yeah.
So the connection between that and substance abuse, I think, is pretty clear. There were a surprising number of older men who said some version of, when my wife died,
I noticed that.
Yeah. When my wife died, I couldn't hold it together. And so I've been homeless ever since then.
Yeah.
And I was shocked at how many older white guys, and not just white guys, but older men in particular, that seemed to be a piece of the story. For young people and teenage people, a lot of them that are LGBTQ come out to their families and get kicked out.
Wow.
A fair number of people that I met, younger people, that was their story. And I think statistics bear that out as well.
Wow.
Yeah, so I've learned a ton about this, which I didn't expect to. I've gotten to talk to lots of people that run shelters and organizations around the country, and tremendous, all the stuff that people are doing to try to help.
Well, and that's one of the things, that's one of the reasons why I asked the question, is because I know whenever I've done, you know, like I told you, I helped lead a task force on homelessness in East Texas. And one of the things I found was that, one, a lot of people are homeless before they even realize they're homeless. For instance, you know, that single mom that is taking her children to a motel, she's homeless. She doesn't have a home, but she doesn't realize, and she doesn't want to admit she's homeless. Then all of a sudden it's the couch surfing, and then all of a sudden then when they're under a bridge, they go, okay, now I'm homeless. And so that was eye-opening to me to go, man, homelessness starts way before. And the thing I wanted to ask you about the substance abuse, and you may not be able to answer this because I know there is this, and I have this conception a lot, that there's a very large contingency of folks that are living on the streets that are either mentally incapacitated or substance abuse. Were you able to tell, and again, I know this wasn't your mission on this deal, but I'm just kind of curious. I would think that there, not all in all instances would substance abuse lead to homelessness. I would think that there are probably many instances where homelessness leads to substance abuse. For instance, I believe there was one individual that you interviewed, an African American, said he had gone back to school when he was 50 years old, and he drinks because it helps numb the pain of being homeless. So it's kind of the chicken or the egg, you know. And I was wondering, could you get a sense of that?
Yeah, well, there was another guy you may remember. I forgot his first name right now, but he was in Indianapolis, I believe, or Cincinnati. I think it was Cincinnati. Said that he's actually a recovering alcoholic. And he says, I don't go to
the shelter. Yep.
Because there's too much drugs and alcohol there. He says, I stay under the bridge to stay sober.
Yeah.
I think what I uncovered is that there's definitely a connection between mental illness and substance abuse. A lot of the folks with mental illness obviously don't have health care. They don't have a way to get meds. And for them, sometimes drinking and drugs is how they kind of maintain some sort of balance.
Yeah.
Obviously not the best way, not ideal, but that's their plan for the short term. I think others, and I've got tons of friends that are in 12-step and have, you know, in the recovery community. I know a fair amount about that. And drinking and drugs is a symptom.
Yeah.
And so what's under it, and the thing, if there is a common thread that seems to be under a lot of people's stories, is that there is some low self-esteem that came from either being abandoned, being abused, whatever has happened in their past life that contributes, at least in some way, to this notion that they can't see themselves getting out of this, or they haven't figured out a way out of it. And so, you know, I'm not a professional, so I don't know what is really true about that. But I do sense that for a lot of people, self-esteem is a piece of the story.
Yeah. Now, I want to take this back to you, and I want to get a little bit philosophical for a moment, in that what you're doing, it seems that you're pursuing you've found a strong purpose. And we talked about that a little bit before we got online, that, you know, it's so critical to find what your purpose in life is. And I got to believe you wake up every day and realize, hey, I'm bringing awareness to something that we all know about, we all know exists, but in a really profound way. What has it meant to you to, with just your happiness, your joy, getting out of bed every morning, knowing that you have found that thing? And the reason why I ask this, Willie, is because I try to preach over and over to my daughters, as well as to this audience, and anyone that'll listen, find what you love first. I always tell people that, look, if your love and your passion only pays you $40K a year, guess what? You will create a $40K a year lifestyle to keep doing that thing. Because a lot of times the $400K a year lifestyle or the thing that you're doing makes for a lifestyle that's awful. It seems to me you have found a way to exercise your art, but now you've created this really cool, purposeful thing in addition to it. What has that meant to you, and how did you do that? How did this all come about, if you were to just philosophically surmise it?
I'm a bit baffled by parts of it because I feel like the homeless piece of this was sort of accidental. Mm-hmm. What I'm really clear about, and when I think about my personal mission, that what I'm really clear about is that part of my mission is about encouraging people to express themselves, whatever that means, and to do it boldly. Mm. And because I'm hoping that the more people that do that, we create a safer world, a more joyful world, et cetera. So that's kind of big picture. The homeless piece of this for me, it is an art project. And so creatively, it has been incredibly gratifying to see a project take off like this. And, you know, one of the many ripples from the media coverage we got when we started going across the country is there were little short video clips about this project. And there have now been millions of views on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram in English, French, and Russian.
Wow.
It's like every time one of these videos gets produced, it seems like it goes viral and quickly. And so I feel unwittingly like this project has tapped into a lot of people's frustration and feeling of helplessness. And so that's been gratifying. It's something in my classroom, obviously at SMU, I'm teaching creativity and portfolio development. And so in my way there, I feel like from a purpose perspective, I am encouraging and pushing and trying to get these students to really become themselves and to be as good as they can be. This is just gravy because I bring this project into the classroom. Some of them light up, and I think some of them already have ideas about causes yeah. they're passionate about.
Yeah.
But if I was going to sum this all up to answer your question, the big takeaway in terms of joy and whatever is really around gratitude.
Yeah.
You can't buy homeless signs day after day after day without a daily reminder of how grateful I am. And my car always has usually between 10 and 300 homeless signs in it. It smells of the humanity of those signs. Those pieces mm-hmm. of cardboard have human sweat in them. Yeah. And I'm reminded almost daily of just how good I have it. Right. And so gratitude for me is the baseline for everything else. And I find it really hard to complain about almost anything anymore.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for so many things. And this project is just like this constant reminder. Keep doing it. I do have fun doing it. I love doing the exhibits. I love the signs. I love all the people I get to meet. But at its core, I am just so grateful that I get to do something that I give a shit about.
Yeah, right, right. Well, and there's something too that this has nothing to do. I mean, I'm terrible about going in chronological order. I try to create a path. But one question I wanted to get in, and again, it's one of those that maybe this has surfaced over since 1993, maybe it hasn't. But you talked about on the other side of the sign. You talked about the abuse that that sign can bring. The person who had never in their life held up a cardboard sign saying, I need help, or like the sign behind you that reads, need Bible, food, clothes, coat, blanket, God bless you. They'd never done that. Probably never at any time in their life thought, I'm going to one day be standing holding a sign just saying, hey, please, I'll take whatever you can spare. And then a year later, now that sign is a part of their identity. So my question is, did you, or throughout your travels, did any of them bring up to you like that first day they stood and held a sign, because their identity is completely, I can't even get my brain wrapped around that. As I sit here and process that with you right now, what that must have been like, because imagine you're standing there for the first time and your life has come to that. Did any of them discuss that with you, or have you ever had that?
What I remember discussing it with several people is that they said, none of them said, this is what I planned to be when I grew up.
Right.
And so, yes, in some cases, people talked about their path to getting there, but nobody plans to get there. Nobody understands what it's like. And I've done it as part of art projects, you know, being on the street holding a sign. And let me tell you, I don't have the constitution to do it for an hour, much less for 8 hours a day, day after day.
Yeah.
It's too much abuse. It is, it's demoralizing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that that is probably, that'd be another interesting question to ask people about how do you associate with this part of your life now?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I don't think anybody wants to be doing that.
Right. Well, and you know, as I look around your studio here and I see the signs, I'm reminded of in Tyler at the Children's Advocacy Center, there's this wall. And one of my business partners and I, we started supporting the Children's Advocacy Center a number of years ago. And so they gave us a tour, and there's a wall that has little handprints on it. And they're all handprints of children that have come through the Advocacy Center. And so there's something about it that just, it's like, brings home the reality, those little handprints of a child that has suffered some form of abuse. And as I look around, I see these signs, you know, they all represent a life. You know, it's real. It really brings an illustration to this, because when we talk about the homeless in kind of a generic sense, you know, when you see the signs, and so that's why I think that what you're doing is so very powerful from an awareness standpoint.
Well, the other thing, you know, I appreciate that, and I've had the experience of being at lots of installations around the country, some big, some small, but I remember in particular being in, there's an event called Art Prize in Grand Rapids, Michigan that happens every year, and I was fortunate to have a venue to do an exhibit there. In 3 weeks, 300,000 people walked through these signs. And so, and I was only able to be there on the weekends. So when I was there, I was just, my mouth was hanging open at the sea of humanity walking through these signs. And I have a badge around my neck that says artist, but most people are like, it's so many people, they don't even notice me. But occasionally, people would look over and see me. And I can't tell you how many dozens of people walked up to me, tears streaming down their face, strictly from just having spent 10 minutes reading a bunch of signs.
Yeah.
And they would come up to me and say some version of, I'm never going to look at a homeless person the same way again.
Yep.
And it was strictly because, and here's one of the thing, the secrets I think I've uncovered about the signs is that there isn't a person there, so they can lean in.
Absolutely.
And they can experience the sign.
Absolutely.
That to me has been a surprise, because I didn't realize that that's partly why I think they're so effective, because there is a lot of humanity just looking at the different handwriting. I'm looking at the ones behind you as well, and I'm realizing each one of these is such a personal expression of somebody. And sometimes they're trying to be funny. They're making a joke, you know, looking for a future ex-wife.
Yeah, yeah.
That's funny, but the story behind that is not funny.
Yeah, exactly.
I believe I bought that sign from a guy in Las Vegas, and I remember the story is never funny, even when the sign, you know, when they're trying to bring a smile to somebody's face, hoping to make a connection.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that you're onto something, that there is something about the signs that is fundamentally different than seeing a person.
Absolutely. Well, another thing I equate it to, first time I ever went to the Holocaust Museum in D.C., The whole exhibit is moving. I mean, you can't, you have to be an extremely calloused and hard person to walk through that and not be moved, right? But at the end, when you see all the shoes and you realize, whoa, this isn't just, there were human feet in those shoes that suffered a hellish, you know, experience that we will never know. There's something to that. These are real. And so
they're sweat stains. Oh, I mean, if you look at the edges where their hands, some of them where their hands held the sign for, in some cases, years, there's embedded sweat in some of these signs. And that's part of the texture of the signs that I think people get.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be an artist. You don't have to be a sociologist to get that. You see it and you know.
Right.
And I think that's part of what the power of it is that the humanity in the signs shines through.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things, too, that I think, and you kind of expressed this, it was either in the film or on one of your TED Talks that I saw, where, you know, there may be some folks that are cynical about it. You're an artist, and you're using homeless signs to create your art, right? And I just want to, you know, my take on that is, God bless you, brother, for being willing to, you know, because it's so weird. You know, Gary Vaynerchuk's a guy that I watch a lot, and his whole deal is know yourself and don't give a flip about what anybody else says, right? You know, and I can tell you that I think you have found an amazing way to use your gift, your talent for expression, and to bring some awareness. That's so. Why wouldn't you do that? Why wouldn't you use your gift? You know, I mean, I had this big idea. You know, I told you of my latest book that got published. I told Jemlyn, you've kind of inspired me. I told her before I even got the book published again. I said, you know, one of the things I want to do with this book, like the podcast, I want to use it as a platform to get good messages out. I don't care if anything comes back to me monetarily. It's about, you know, hey, there's some people listening. Let's let them hear some cool stuff. I wanted to take my book and stand with a person with a sign and go and put and have my own sign, free book if you'll donate to him or donate to her, you know? And I was like, man, people are going to think this is just a cheap marketing ploy. I'm like, who cares? If it helps somebody, right? So anyway, I just think that I just admire the fact that even with the naysayers or whatever, that you've marched forward, because I think you're doing something very, very important. And you're right. It's weird, the thought. It's so simple of how many times would we stop and read a sign if the individual was holding it? But now you're attaching humanity to it with the human not even being there in a way that is pretty remarkable.
Well, I appreciate that. And I'll say this, that first of all, like, there's an Upworthy video on Facebook that has over 6.4 million views, and I don't know how many thousands of comments. It's been shared 80,000 times. So I remember spending maybe an hour reading 100, you know, and so there's thousands of comments I've never read.
Yeah.
But my experience is that for every one negative, and there's just so few negative ones,
yeah,
that 99% of the comments I've read and the feedback I get and the messages people send me are all, they want to share a story about somebody in their family who's homeless, or they want to talk about, wow, this has caused me, I'm going to go teach my students to do this, or, you know, I don't know how much of this you've seen, but I got mentioned in a tweet 2 years ago or so by a high school in the UK. And this came out of nowhere. You know, I'm like, oh, somebody mentioned me in a tweet. I look at the tweet. It's from Studley High School, which is in the UK. And it says their 10-year students, their sophomores, are working on an art project about homelessness and drawing. And they had three inspirations: Henry Moore, Leonardo da Vinci, and me.
Wow.
And so I, of course, laughed out loud, but and I realized that, suck it, Henry Moore and Leonardo, y'all don't have Twitter. Y'all don't have a Twitter handle.
Wow.
So I was the only one tagged, but it was like my mind kind of freaked out. I didn't know anybody at this school.
Yeah.
And I went to their website. There was this huge write-up about it and pictures of the students' work. And I was blown away. Some of the kids were doing these amazing drawings of homeless people's hands and feet. and others were making sculptures out of cardboard. And I was just like, the ripples from a project can be way outside of where I think.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, to your point, you know, bless everybody. If they don't like something, that's okay. I don't care if somebody likes it or not. I do, and it is something that I regularly think about. How do I get out of this equation? How do I keep me out of the equation? And I realize I can't be completely out of the equation, and that's okay.
Yeah,
I'm going to keep doing my thing, and you know, whatever happens, happens, and I'm okay with whatever.
Well, you know, I think it was, I've said this on the podcast before, it's one of my favorite quotes. Dave Grohl, the founder of the Foo Fighters, he said, if you do something good enough for long enough, eventually somebody's going to notice. And, you know, I think that's what you've done. Talk to me now as we kind of wrap this up. I want to be respectful of your time. I could literally go on and on for hours on this.
This has been fun, man.
Oh, this has been the highlight of as the year comes to a close, man. Just when I think I've crushed my best podcast, you know, then I get to meet someone like you.
Well, thank you.
What is your hope now for Signs of Humanity? We're all homeless. Where do you go from here? Because, like you said, this is almost an accidental thing, right? But now I'm telling you, Willie, it's so powerful. I think you've got, you really have the ability to kick a dent in the universe with this. What do you want to do?
Well, I have a really long list of things to do, most of which requires time and money, and I'm always short on both. But, you know, I leave tomorrow night to fly to Boston to do an exhibit there. In February, I'm going to be doing an exhibit in Alaska, the Anchorage Museum. In between, I speak to students. On January 1st, we're going to be doing with Vogel Alcove here in Dallas. They've got a thing called Day One Dallas. We'll be doing an art workshop for kids, letting them make a little work of art, answering the question, what is home? And they usually have 12 to 15,000 people at this event on January 1st. So I've got a pretty full schedule of exhibits and speaking and just continuing to do that sort of thing. I have other bodies of work that I want to create. I really want to pitch a TV series called Signs of Humanity that seems like a no-brainer, each episode in a different city. And I've talked to some people about it, and I've still not completed my pitch deck yet, but that to me seems like, believe me, there's a lot of crap out on TV right now. This seems like a no-brainer.
Absolutely.
So that's one. I would love to do a documentary, a full-length documentary about Eddie Dunn.
Yeah.
I think his story alone is worth telling. There's another man in Lansing, Michigan called Chris Pruitt, who is another homeless guy that I would love to tell you his story sometime, but I'd love to do a documentary about him. I'm in the midst of a book, and I keep pushing that aside for other things, but producing a book of some of the better signs and telling some of the history of this project, and I also want to include some of the answers to what is home throughout the book as well.
Yeah.
So there's, and I have some other kind of crazier art things related to this that I would like to explore. All of it just takes time, and in some cases, money. The TV and movie production obviously is an expensive thing, but I feel like the momentum just keeps picking up. It was earlier this year that we got contacted by this Russian media company called TOK. In broken English, they emailed me asking if they could do a little video about this project. And next thing I know, a video is on their Instagram, and it has over 450,000 views. I'm getting all these Russian followers to our Instagram account, and it was like, I don't even know how to wrap my head around this, but apparently it makes sense in other languages.
Yeah.
And so my hope and dream is just that I stay healthy and I can keep doing this. And what I've also started to learn is that there are some things that I can empower other people to do, because I've had students lead workshops without me even being there for the kids. And I realized, wait, I don't have to necessarily be at everything.
Right.
So it's just more of the same. I want to keep bringing it into my classroom, because I promise you, I have students who are going to come up with their own projects that are going to go out and solve aspects of, you know, other problems. And so if this can help do that too, I think that's another cool ripple.
Awesome. Willie, I am so grateful for this time. Thank you for sharing this story. And to the listeners out there, follow Willie and what he's doing. Again, go watch the movie, the documentary. You will not be sorry. Signs of Humanity. It's on Amazon Prime. Go see it. Willie, thank you, brother. Hey, folks, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Texas Titans podcast. Before you go, I wanted to let you know where you can find us out there on the interwebs. You can go to show notes as well as listen to all the past episodes and look for upcoming shows at texttitans.blog. Also, that has all the different formats that you can listen to the show on if you go there. So texttitans.blog. You can also go to jasonrightnow.com. That has not only a link to the podcast, but it also has a link to my Make Your Own Rules blog that I think you'll enjoy. So please check that out. Also, it has information about my executive coaching business, speaking, and anything else like that. So jasonrightnow.com. That's literally just my name, jasonrightnow.com. On Twitter, I'm at jasonwrighttx. I would really appreciate a follow. I have not been a big Twitter user, so I need you guys to help me with that. So please take the time to go out to jasonwrighttx, find me, and follow me. I'm trying to get more active with it. And so if you'll engage with me, I'll try to do a better job of engaging with you. So I would appreciate that. And then on Instagram, I'd really appreciate a follow there. I'm at jasonrightnow. Again, my name, now. So please follow me on Instagram. And then on Facebook, I'm also at jasonwrighttx. So check us out there. I'm also on LinkedIn, so look for me there. I try to use as many platforms as possible to let you know about upcoming shows, past shows, and then also just anything that I find interesting. I'm trying to push it out and get better with the social media. So please check us out there and follow us. I would be most grateful. And also, please do not forget, it means the world to me for you to go to iTunes, give us a rating. Right now, we've got that 5-star rating. I'm hoping to hold that. Please, please, please. The comments that people are writing are so very kind. Thank you so much. It means the world to me. And that's how we keep moving up in the ranks. And right now, we're crushing it with downloads. The show has really had incredible feedback thanks to you guys. So I'm grateful. Please keep that momentum going by giving us a review on iTunes. Thanks so much and have a great day. And as always, I could not be more grateful for you listening. Thanks.